So this week we thought we'd try something a bit different because we had the podcast earlier in the week on the future of religious studies with the proper academics. We thought that we would get together, David and I and some of our friends, and discuss our reactions to the podcast and some of our own ideas. So before we get going, we should probably go around the table and introduce ourselves. I'll start. You know, I'm Chris. I'm not currently studying at the moment, but I've just recently finished my master's at Edinburgh looking at non-religious identities, and I'm interested in new religious movements and non-religion and identity and all that sort of thing. Shall we go to Ethan next?
I'm Ethan Cohen. I study atheism, specifically the atheist narrative of Ian McEwan. That's about all I've got to say.
Perfect.
I shall pass off to Jonathan.
Hello, I'm Jonathan. I'm studying phenomenology and doing a PhD at the University of Stirling.
I'm Kevin Whitesides. I'm doing a master's by research at University of Edinburgh on the 2012 millennialism, and I'm interested in looking at new religious movements generally.
Hi, my name is Liam Sutherland. I'm doing a research master's in religious studies on the role and relevance of Edward Burnett Tylor in modern theories of religion.
Hi, I'm David, as I'm sure regular listeners will know, and I am working on a PhD involving the intersection between New Age spirituality and conspiracy theories. And maybe as co-host, I should kick off by saying, what was the original point was about the finances. What do we all think about the way that this situation is playing out? There's going to be a lot fewer jobs in the UK anyway, and that's probably going to impact us as a group more than anybody else listening to this, because we're the people who are going to be looking for jobs in between 2 and 3 years' time. Chris, I know we were talking about this last night, weren't we? Yeah.
Not that I can just jump in and say that my big problem with the whole finance thing is that it's being monetized so much, and the government are sort of giving funding to degree programs which have a sort of clear career path, and religious studies, whilst I think personally is the most important thing that anyone could be studying, obviously I would say that because I study it, but it doesn't have an obvious application to a career. Future students look at it and they think, well, what job am I going to get with that? The government looks at it and they say, well, we're not training people for a science career or for teaching or for anything obviously career related. So we're in a nasty situation.
There's a big irony of the fact that we're studying matters of ultimate concern, but it's of very little concern to anybody outside of our discipline. Yes, and the only jobs that are going to be going in a few years' time seem to be related to Islam.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and we get that through all the academic mailing lists at the moment. The only job ads that you see are...
And women. Islam and women, and preferably Islamic women. There's lots of conferences about that.
Yeah, it's you know, assistant professorship in Middle Eastern studies or in Islam or Islam in the West, because that is what... quote, ordinary people, unquote, are interested in. And it's got obvious benefits for governments and stuff to have people who understand the Middle East.
This coming from a round table of men.
Yeah.
Interesting.
None of whom study Islam either.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we did invite some women, but they were all applying for conferences on Islam and women, so yeah. Couldn't come.
To give a bit of perspective for the Americans in the room, the issue here dealing with price increases and decreases of funding for religious studies. In the U.S., I just remember when I was doing my master's at Cal State Long Beach, there was this issue of when they were promoting the religious studies program and the catalog, under the description of jobs you could have after you're done with your degree was priest, and then sort of social worker, state worker, government employee. It didn't really have anything in there that said you could do anything with religious studies at the same time. And as far as funding for subjects such as religious studies that's, I mean, I don't know if Kevin, you've had the same issue, but there's sort of like, really, that's what you're going to do with religious studies? You know, you can't do something that actually gives back to the community. So, you know, the different perspective of seeing you guys having to go through issues of lack of funding and having to pay outrageous amounts to actually go to school. And, you know, in comparison to us, it's sort of like, you gotta be kidding me. You guys are just, you know, mooching about nonsense. But at the same time, you know, it is a field of subject that seems to be very difficult to get people behind and support.
Well, that American perspective is reflected actually in the American contribution to the podcast that we're talking about, and Don Weeb's comment. A lot of it is about the relationship between theology and mm-hmm. religious studies, which I believe is more of an issue in the States. Here, it's all Islam, but in the States, well, if he's to be believed anyway, there's certainly theology is really taking over.
Really?
That's what the money is.
Really?
Mm.
I don't know if I'd say it, because we have such a great distinction, but a grand distinction between theology, which is essentially your divinity schools, and religious studies. And from two state schools that I went to, it's just religious studies. There is no such thing as sort of theology. You look at it through a religious studies lens. We're not trying to find answers. We're trying to ask the right kind of questions and essentially look into how you approach, not so much answering, but just in analyzing those questions. But then at Baylor, we have the divinity school. That's a completely separate organization from the religion department, which is only a department on Christianity, the history of Christianity, and specifically in the American Southern context. But that's the only place I would ever find that I ever saw in the U.S. But maybe I'm sort of, you know.
Just to repeat something Dr. Cox said quite a long time ago in the theory and method class, that actually a lot of the problems are that it's not so much whether how the departments are structured, as that funding bodies identify religious studies with the church and identify it with, you know, other bodies which fund theological projects. So, for example, as he said, you know, they'll see a religious studies project and think, oh, the church will fund this, when of course they won't, because it's got nothing to do with theology.
Yeah, so the crisis there is assuming that someone else will pay for it. The money stops flowing from the government, it starts coming from the church instead, and that skews the whole thing. Or Islamic organisations, which is what's happening.
The church is quite happy to fund theological projects, even, you know, that they won't fund religious studies projects,
exactly,
because they've got nothing to do with it.
Whereas my big thing is that religious studies, you're studying psychology, philosophy, history, geography, sociology, anthropology, history, mm-hmm. theology, all of these things, and you get a really broad perspective. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that sense, it's quite a general degree, like your sort of undergraduate degree in religious studies would be quite general, but you're getting a very wide perspective and training in lots of methodological and theoretical positions. But essentially what you're studying, and I know that, well, there's two of us here who are looking at people who technically aren't religious, mm-hmm. and we've got David and Kevin who are looking at some conspiracy theories and religion, or, well, is it religion?
What is not normally accepted as religion.
Yeah, what is not normally accepted as religion. So, like, this is stuff which goes right to the heart of popular culture, and even we just had Linda Woodhead, we interviewed her earlier in the week, talking about secularization. Even with secularization, that still doesn't push religious studies out of the mainstream. You can look at anything mainstream from religious studies, and what you're learning is about people and what motivates them and what drives them and how they're going to relate to each other and how they're going to interact. And I think there's barely anything more important that you could be studying.
Well, naturally, I think religious studies is actually an incredibly critical discipline, regardless of what is often said about it. There's a consistent attempt, even the consistent attempt to get away from theology has, I think, good effects in the attempt to relate everything to the human, but in to draw on different approaches, which is possibly, you know, sometimes some of the problems of specific disciplines, that we actually look at different disciplines and try and thread them together, and there is a general theme of what is religion or distinct religious traditions, and these are incredibly important for trying to understand these things, which are, you know, of immense use to the public.
In a sense, I think that kind of stands against religious studies in the sense that it's drawing together all these various disciplines. You think, thinking in terms of things like sociology and anthropology, which have existed as departments much longer than a religious studies department. And here we come along and we say that we're drawing on the works of these people. So the obvious question then for the outsider is, well, why does the religious studies department exist? Why is this not just part of the sociology or the anthropology department? Why do we need a religious studies department in its own right? Why is it not just subsumed under these other different disciplines and do it that way? Because as Carol Cusack says, a lot of people who are graduating in religious studies and wishing to do further research are finding themselves going into these very departments that we're trying to break away from, because that's where the jobs are.
But we sort of exist as a check and balances, you know, and from the US perspective, we have different branches of government to do this specifically, that we have a check and balances between each one, so not one of them has too much power. We do the exact same thing. Religious studies reminds everybody that, yes, religion is extremely important in culture and society, but it is separate from anthropology. It's separate from sociology. It is a separate entity in itself. And we're needed here to sort of remind theology that it's not just about how God interacts in your life, because we're not just dealing with God. We're dealing with so many different aspects of what religion really means. Because the sort of monothetic definition of religion is a belief or a practice or worship a deity, a specific deity, a monotheistic deity, reminding them not so much. No, religion can be so many different other things, including non-religion or anti-religion or atheism, which is also religious philosophy. So that's why we're necessary.
But I think perhaps another issue that comes into it, we're talking very much so about the university level of religious studies, but what we should actually be also looking at is younger people, because right now they're talking about what counts as a GCSE and what doesn't count as a GCSE. And one of the subjects that they are threatening to take away GCSE status from is religious studies. So if religious studies is no longer a GCSE, we're actually killing our future already, because there will be no students who want to study GCSEs because it's no longer a valid qualification for universities. So we'll lose interest at the younger level.
I think it's a really important point, but I also think it's exacerbated by the fact that what kids learn as they don't do religious studies, they do religious and ethical studies or something, which automatically conflates religion and ethics. And there's no continuity. Now, I didn't do religious and moral education or whatever they call it.
Neither did I.
I don't think anybody did.
Religious, social, philosophical, moral education or something like that in Scotland.
And what religious studies at school or whatever it's called produces is this kind of uncritical individual. I was at a conference in London in December that was on teaching and studying religion, and there was a presentation given by a religious education teacher who was doing a PhD now in religious studies, looking at how it is taught in schools. And she was saying that, you know, there's this whole philosophy that you can't critique anything. You can just sort of teach facts, and the kids get this imbued into them that they aren't allowed to criticize one another's views, because you'll have a few Muslims, a few Christians, a few atheists, and they all will sort of say what their opinion is, maybe, and then everyone will go, well, that's nice. And is that learning? Is that exchanging? Is it comparing? No, that is just training individuals to just not ask questions.
I think that's a major misunderstanding of religious studies in general. It's not that we are devoid of religion. We don't sterilize ourselves to the point that we have we're basically just nothingness and all that kind of stuff. We do have beliefs, so we do actually believe certain things about certain religions, but we are also trained and skilled in the idea of looking at religion from different perspectives. And I have no religious beliefs whatsoever that you would call as being sacred or whatsoever as being an atheist, but I can still look at religion and understand what the person who practices it understands, and what they believe, and how it affects their lives. So I think that's a major misconception about religious studies, is that We're not all atheists, don't
we? Or agnostic.
Definitely not.
So, yeah. But, you know, we're
50%
not
of us are, just to clarify.
We're not all, you know, we're not all these sort of atheistic people who look at religion as this bizarre phenomenon that we can't really understand, so we have to sterilize it. It's just that we look at it in a specific way that we make sure we don't put our own bias into studying it. I think that's a major issue.
The other tack is for the public to assume that we do comparative religion, that what we do is we look at Hinduism and Buddhism and Christianity and we find the things that are essential
which
about them
better.
Yeah. And we go, well, you know, okay, Buddhism doesn't have a god, but it's a bit like God, isn't it? And we find the bit that could be considered the holy book and we go, oh look, it's all the same thing, so you're all, we're all fine, we're all one. Isn't that a happy world?
We're not interfaith.
Yeah, that would be a theological enterprise.
I think the important thing is, though, we've been highlighting, we've been kind of edging on this issue, is public education. And I think actually this is the future of religious studies. With more public engagement, more public awareness of the critical side of religious studies, I actually think we do have a future if we become more conscious of our public role and our public role. And that involves having to become a bit more intelligible, a bit less wrapped up in, you know, kind of abstract deconstructions and that kind of thing, actually more able to discuss the complexity of religion, the complexity of even the term religion, but generally the complexity of the things that are labelled religion.
Can I just ask you what you mean by the term critical? Because
that's important.
It's very important because critical can sometimes have the same connotations as comparative.
Negative.
Because this is one of the things that is coming up in my study on phenomenology. I have been looking at phenomenologists of religions and philosophical phenomenologists. And what you notice is that phenomenologists of religion take up the terms used by philosophical phenomenologists, but they don't necessarily pay attention to the way in which those terms were used. For instance, the term critical appears in the philosophy of Husserl, but it's not meant in the way that most people understand the term of critical, of assessing religions in terms of which one is better and which one is worse and why it doesn't work and this one is stupid and anything. Assessment like that. Yep. But Husserl, critical means very concise, very ethical practices when you are studying a phenomenon.
Thank you for picking me up on that point. Actually, I think that's a very valid point, because critical, I think even for scholars sometimes is used to mean, in effect, even though they wouldn't admit it, is used to mean negative things. Whereas that's not what we're trying to do. We're just trying to really get at the heart of meaning, to understand how things are related to social structure. You know. That kind of thing, really, to make a human discipline. That's how I interpret it, anyway. But
I'm just gonna. Well, Ethan.
When you also mentioned public religion, what do you, or public education, what do you mean by public education?
I just mean in public engagement with the public, and in general, trying to teach them.
You're speaking outside of university.
Not entirely. I just mean more accessibility, more a willingness to actually promote our discipline to the media, perhaps, to actually say, look, we've got a role. We to teach the complexity of religion without necessarily having to resort to either traditional narratives of religion or to, you know, these modern interfaith narratives, which all may be very useful, but at the end of the day, I think stressing the complexity, the fact the differences are in some ways more important than similarities.
Yes, because, you know, that's a lot of the reason why we started this podcast was to engage with the public.
Yes.
And a big problem we're talking about here with funding, if the public don't know what religious studies is, like the vast majority of people, as we've mentioned, especially when we're talking to Don, when you mention that you're doing religious studies, public perception is that you are religious and that you are engaged in some sort of training for a religious ministry.
And then when you say, I'm an atheist, they go, so why are you interested in religion? It's the only subject where that happens. Nobody goes, oh, I'm doing engineering. Oh, right, are you made out of metal then? Are you made from gears? No. So why are you interested in engineering? What, I'm doing psychology. Oh, are you insane? No. So why are you interested in insane?
I'm going to refer to Kevin here. In sort of an American perspective, when you said you were getting a degree in religious studies, what was the reaction from, like, friends and family?
Yeah, I mean, they usually say, what are you going to do with that?
Well, the great joke is, what do you do with a bachelor's degree in religious studies? Oh, you get a master's degree. Oh, what do you do with a master's degree in religious studies? Oh, you get a PhD. What do you do with a PhD in religious studies? Oh, you work at Starbucks.
I think that's the...
You have Starbucks now, so that works.
That works, yeah. You don't have to translate that.
I think that's the point that Jonathan was referring back to about that actually religious studies people find a lot of work outside of religious studies and all sorts of other things.
I didn't quite mean Starbucks, but okay.
Sociology.
Sociology, Starbucks. Difference, really. You're just helping people.
Just to move discussion on a bit, to bring us back to the future of religious studies, I'm also still with Jonathan here, because he does have to leave. I want to bring up cognitive study of religion, which was a major theme in the interviews with the scholars. I know Jim Cox, Stan Arvinger, and Marcus Davidson were talking about the cognitive study of religion. So I just want to throw out there, what do people think about the cognitive study of religion? Does anyone have a strong opinion that they want to lay on the table?
I think it's great.
No, that's an opinion.
And why do you think it's great?
I think we need... I think of religious studies less as a methodology as the name of a department. And I think the more we can take in any of these different methodologies that have something to say about religious studies, anything that studies anything about humans practically has something to say about religion, and so we might as well take in all these different...
I am not overly impressed, to put it mildly, with the cognitive science of religion.
Strap in, yeah.
I mean, when Geertz gave his own podcast on it, it was very tempered, I thought, and I also found it very interesting the way he used the word how, when he was talking about his experiment, when he was talking about the processes in the brain of people as they're praying. I mean, if that's what the cognitive science does, if that's what it tells us how the brain works when people are engaging in religious practices or religious beliefs, then it's very interesting. But then you have to step from Geertz to Weeb, and you start getting into this explanation of, oh, the cognitive sciences explain why we have religion, why people are religious. And it just strikes me as another revamped version of the kind of evolutionism that the phenomenology of religion was invented to combat and get rid of. I mean, we've already shown how evolutionary theories don't really explain why we have religion, and I think we're going to find exactly the same thing again here with the cognitive sciences.
Yeah, sorry.
If those sorts of fields shed light on the way that culture propagates in certain ways and how certain functions of human biology have tendencies towards thinking in certain ways, or how certain social psychological principles work just on populations in general, those things do speak to religion also. Religion is an aspect of culture, and if all these other disciplines can say something about how culture functions, then that speaks to religion as well.
I mean, I just want to stick my neck out a little bit and say that I feel that when Geertz and others are presenting their methodology at conferences, etc., that they're... it's not hiding the truth so much as presenting a positive spin on it. There's definitely a sort of effort to convince the rest of the scholarly community that, you know, that they're not really trying to explain things, and it's just, you know, another method. But it seems very labored in a way.
Yeah, they are.
But I do.
That's a ridiculous method.
I do value it. I think it's a good first step, and it is good to take the scientific method and try and look at religion, but my problem is that at the moment it doesn't tell you anything. At the moment, all they can do is say bits of the brain light up. Well, bits of the brain light up and all sorts of things. Like, I think it's maybe in 20 or 30 years, the cognitive sciences might actually be able to tell us something, but at the moment, it's all very, very vague.
I would disagree that it doesn't tell you anything. I mean, and certainly in my work, and I suspect that the same would be true for Kevin, is that one of the things that's showing up is how interrelated cultural processes and other intellectual processes and political processes are with our religious impulses. You know, and I mean, I look at Tom Rees' Epiphenom site a lot, and it has a lot of data about the way that certain political groups react to religious stimuli. It's blurring the boundaries, I think, between what we think of as being religion and other forms of cognition, which is a big thing I'm very interested in. I tend to think of religion more as a social epistemology, ways of thinking about the world which we define collectively in groups, which, although not always related to the supernatural, often is, but the cognitive studies are suggesting that the similarities of those two, you know, of the supernatural worldview and the non-supernatural worldview are much more deeply rooted than we had suspected. At the same time, there is definitely an atheistic debunking agenda.
I'm going to take let's go with Liam.
Well, I was going to say that I actually quite like the Geertzian, Armin Geertzian rather than Clifford Geertzian approach.
Which one?
Armin Geertzian.
Okay.
I don't mind the idea of looking at the brain. I don't mind the idea of looking even at cognition in a broad sense, that religion is ultimately rooted in the mind to some extent. Nonetheless, I would say that as with any, certainly when you get to the more extreme forms of cognitivism, any myopic view of religion will always tend to assert religionism versus a social scientific or scientific at all view of religion, when actually the problem with any myopic approach to religion is that it's not to do with the independence of religion or religious beliefs and religious ideas, it's to do with the independence of ideas and the independence of worldviews. And that, for me, is the important thing. Because I think, really, that ultimately, the research into human beings has got more, and I believe in it's a science as well, it's got more to do with appreciating human beings as they are. Just as we have to appreciate any natural object we study through natural sciences, we have to study human beings through the human sciences, and that involves appreciating culture. That any, to be fair, ethnography and things like that will always have far more to say about human beings than the very nascent cognitive sciences, as far as I'm concerned, as far as studying these things.
Well, before Jonathan leaves for his responsibilities,
yeah.
You know, being that I'm on the border of phenomenology and cognitive aspects of religiosity, you know, the idea we're not looking for answers, and I think that's sort of an issue that I keep coming to. We're not actually looking for an answer, and we may utilize the scientific method, but that doesn't mean we're looking for an answer. You know, and that's sort of one of the arguments I've had recently this last week with people about Richard Dawkins and his sort of, you know, the God hypothesis, is that when he speaks of there probably is no God, he's specifically saying that we haven't found evidence yet to prove it.
Yes.
And the idea that we're not necessarily looking for answers, that when we put forth the sort of cognitive scientific method of looking at religion, when we use the scientific method, we're not exactly looking for results that we can use as a standard answer, as a concrete answer. We may come up with a hypothesis and a question, and in the end, we might come with a result that says, you know, we were wrong to begin with.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that comes along with the sort of phenomenological method of looking at polythetic definitions of religion and what is religiosity. And we do the same thing when I'm looking at that, what defines atheism and how you define that in a contemporary version or contemporary world, as Chris can sort of, you know, back me up on with his studies on contemporary atheism as he busies himself with the camera. But, you know, the whole idea, we're not looking for specific answers. We're just looking at a way of looking, of analyzing how a certain social construct affects the lives of people who actually believe in what they believe. And, you know, to I don't know exactly what my point is on this, but the whole idea of looking at trying to find answers is not something we do. We don't look for answers. We look for ways of finding understanding of how things come about.
In which case, you know, I know I sounded a bit negative about cognitive science earlier. I'm not entirely. I love them. You know, I think it's great. I think that's the brilliant thing about religious studies is using interdisciplinarity, using different, and actually the fact that we are now bringing in a hard science into religious studies and saying, look, we can use brain scans, we can use all this, and essentially it doesn't actually prove anything either way. You know, if a religious person looks at the cognitive sciences and sees that we are evolutionarily developed to have a certain area of the brain which responds and which is predisposed to be religious, that's fine. That's compatible, and it's just as compatible with an atheistic worldview as it is with a religious worldview. It's just looking at the human being as they are.
I would disagree with that. I don't like the hard sciences going into religion. I don't like it. You look at Sam Harris's moral landscape. It's not good.
But that just fails because it fails. It's not
because it fails, but I don't like the idea of, you know, we need to scientifically scan the brain to understand what happens when someone prays.
Well, I don't understand. Story is that it doesn't actually explain anything.
No, it just
says the same thing that we always knew, which was human cultures make religions.
We knew that.
But see, I wouldn't even go that far because it sort of bastardizes the whole thing. We don't need to scientifically study the brain to understand what happens when someone prays because it doesn't really matter.
Exactly.
Well, if I can just interrupt at this point, I think Ethan's comment right there just summarized the two points that I wished to make was, firstly, the original question was going to be to ask Liam what he meant by the term science. We're now talking about the human sciences and the social sciences and the hard sciences, but what do we mean by the term science? And the other thing that I wanted to mention was when you talked about like this process of studying the brain. The problem is that one of the premises is that I've had in my own thesis is that any method will imply a theory to test. So the very method itself that is produced in cognitive science is leading itself towards this theory of explaining why we have religions. And that's the problem. The very question is built into the method itself, even if the people who are using the method are unaware of that theory or are unwilling to admit that the theory is there.
Attentive listeners will notice that Jonathan Tuckett just avoided the subject of defining what it was that science is. So, Jonathan Tuckett, University of Stirling.
Well, actually, I'm more interested in what Liam was going to say on
the listeners aren't. Define science.
Jonathan Tuckett.
I'm going to do time. Come on. I am the editor.
Wow.
I'll try.
Boom.
They probably define it pretty well. I'll just say go with him.
When we define science as an etymological definition.
Let John. Jonathan is offering to do it.
Do it.
Do it.
Do it.
In a very, very vague sense, I guess science is anything that is testable. So any sort of study that someone does that can be reproduced. In a sense, English, by that I mean English literature, is a science. When someone writes a dissertation, like I had a friend who wrote a dissertation on the representation of sexual diseases in a certain period of literature. It's a scientific experiment because she's picked out certain books, she's asked a question, and she comes to certain conclusions. And then someone else can come along and read the book, and they can read the same books that she studied and say, actually, the conclusion she has come to doesn't work, or they can read other books from that period and say, actually, based on this other evidence from these other books, it doesn't work, or it does work. So in that sense, science is just the production of questions that once the answer has been produced, you can test the answer.
It's something based on evidence.
Yes.
And evidence followed through logically, and evidence essentially, it is the phenomenology of being honest to the evidence, and that is what we all have to do. So if you have scholars who have their own agendas, and if you have scholars ignoring evidence and not mentioning evidence, then that is not science. Science is looking at the evidence that you've got and drawing conclusions based on that, and when someone presents contradictory evidence or when you discover contradictory evidence, it is your sort of duty to acknowledge that
and change things.
But I think we're putting too much emphasis on evidence. I think, you know, the scientific aspect of, like, CSI or some nonsense, or the evidence provides the answer and nonsense like that. But this is a completely different aspect of evidence, and I think we're putting too much emphasis on evidence as being this sort of concrete ideology that, in this aspect, evidence can always change. It can always be something completely different from different perspectives and different contexts.
And because when we're studying religion, I'll get to Jonathan, but I have a brilliant point that I want. This is actually a point that I've bastardized from David Wilson, who we all know, and he will be involved in the project at some point. But as he says, the problem with science is that it emphasizes repeatability too much. So it's like you have a laboratory, you can do an experiment, and then someone else can take the experiment and repeat it. But with religious experience, with any experience of a person, people's
repetitive religious experience, it hasn't been proven that it exists.
This is true. But with any experience of people, you cannot repeat that experience. And the only way scholars have access to it is by listening to what people say, what people write, watching what people do, and now we've got scanning people's brains while they say they're having an experience, but it's not repeatable.
But that's why the scientific study of religion is limited. It can only answer certain questions, and that, I think, the idea that any particular methodology of looking at religion is going to tell you the whole story about religion is what the problem is. That's why we need all of these different methodologies from all these different fields to be looking at it and each providing their own piece of the data, because all of them are limited in certain ways, but usefully so, because if you don't have people specializing in those certain fields, they can't take it to a certain depth. So as long as we apparently have this overpopulation, why not use those people for different multitasking abilities?
But to rely... Oh, sorry, I forgot Jonathan was coming in. I'll make a quick point. to rely too heavily on the physical sciences in the social sciences, we run the risk of devaluing it. I mean, a study of the works of Shakespeare, which goes, well, the paper was made out of atoms, and therefore we've explained the meaning of Shakespeare, why Shakespeare's important.
Exactly.
That type of analysis would not be looking at the meaning of Shakespeare and wouldn't tell you anything
precisely
about the meaning of Shakespeare.
Precisely.
Doesn't this also get us in trouble for being depicted as thinking too much about religious ideology, that we don't really understand the sacredness of it? The fact that we're picking it apart piece by piece and scientifically looking at little details.
Jonathan is having to leave shortly.
Kind of ties into what I was about to say. I mean, we had a seminar a while back from Joaquin Gentz, who actually pointed out that religious studies is one of the most self-conscious fields around in the sense that we are aware that it is a bit of a mess, and none of us really know what religion is or how we're supposed to study it, and we are applying ourselves to that problem. I don't think it necessarily stands against religious studies in that respect. I think the problem is, and this relates back to what we were just saying, is that all this talk of evidence, the catchword that brings it to a close would be the word objectivity. And we're always talking about how we're objective and that the results we're providing are cold, hard facts. And yes, it's a problem, because how do we relate the facts to what we've actually studied? But at the same time, what I've discovered through phenomenology is that we don't really understand what we mean by objectivity to begin with. I mean, there's an ethical understanding, there's an epistemological understanding, there's a metaphysical understanding. And so, like, to quickly plug my own brand of phenomenology, I think we should actually be getting rid of the term objective and objectivity altogether. I mean, our results are not objective in the sense that science is producing objective results about, you know, the structure of atoms. What we're producing is relative results, and these results are relative to the phenomena at the time that we studied them, and therefore they're only applicable to the phenomena at that specific time in that specific location. So of course, when you repeat the experiment, like in Professor Cox's book, he studies a particular ritual in an African village. When you study that, you produce certain results, and you can test the results again. But of course, you're going to get slightly different results, because there's a ton of factors as to why you will get different results, such as whereas the person who's doing the observations is standing, the relationship of the observer to the people doing the practice themselves. So The reason I'm advocating relativity in this respect is that it's one step above subjectivity, which is the postmodernist quagmire of death and destruction that will consume all academic fields if it's allowed to spread too far.
Damn straight.
Continue.
I will. I just can't believe I just said that.
True.
Yep.
This is the future of what is the future of religious studies, not what is the future of all academia ever. But Jonathan has done.
Yeah, pretty much that. Well, unfortunately, this is the problem with. Originally, when I went into phenomenology, I was looking specifically at religion, and the fact about phenomenology is that it's not religion specific. Mm. The aim of the phenomenological method that I wish to supply is that it can be applied to any range of phenomena. I think religion is useful in that respect because it's a very complex phenomenon and it strains the way we look at things. But going back to the question of relativity, I think if our results are relative, it still means that they're testable. You still go back and you still look at that ritual and see what was different this time around to what was different beforehand. And it still makes it a scientifically valuable result because even though you might get certain slight differences, there's still the possibility that the first person who did the study lied his ass off. So if you do it again, you can see, actually, it's completely different. This person was completely wrong. But if you keep doing the tests over and over again, which is a good way to say that religious studies needs to keep going, and that there will never be an end point to religious studies because the phenomena will always change. But you can begin to track those changes.
Yes.
And that's what's important. I think we've got too much into a slightly centralized notions that there is a fact, and once you've got that fact, it is like that for all time. There is no sense of change in our field.
We're not looking for answers. Exactly.
So just before Jonathan goes, quickly, can we ask you, 2 minutes max, what is the future of religious study for Jonathan Tuckett?
I guess I'm going to agree with quite a lot of what was said in the previous answers to the question. There is the financial issue, and it all comes down to finances. But I think what really needs to happen is that religious studies needs to have basically an institutional meeting with itself and say, even though, like, and by that I mean, like, the very university departments need to get together and be like, we are under threat. Why are we under a threat? And we need to speak about how we can make ourselves publicly known. How can we get funding? How can we present ourselves to the public so that people understand what it is that we're trying to do? So unless all the various different university departments get together and actually try and figure out some sort of answer, even if it means that in the changing political climate that in, for instance, say Scotland, only one university has a religious studies department, and the entirety of Scotland consolidates into one building, essentially, that's the way forward.
Whilst we were having the break there, Kevin was saying that he doesn't think that we understand the cognitive study of religion. I'm totally open to that. So, what's your case, Kevin?
Well, on the one hand, I think it's not at all reducible to just look at taking pictures of what the brain's doing. But to the degree that it is that, there actually are very useful things about religion that we can learn, or what that is limited in certain ways, and that they have to be things that you can test and repeat and test. But there are certain things that are amenable to that sort of study, and things can be shown in that way. But beyond that, the cognitive studies are much wider than just looking at people's brains. They look at the basic ways that human minds process information and use that to behave in the world, and to the degree that religion is an aspect of that, just understanding the basic function of how humans process material in general also speaks to how they process religion. And there's other areas of human thought and human behavior that are well understood in the cognitive fields that are analogous in, or they use the same sorts of thought processes as religion often does. But I think the problem is always, and as I said, in any methodology, is when you try to take that one methodology and use that to explain the whole field. And mm-hmm. so to the degree that any cognitive scientists of religion are taking on that task, they're probably not going to succeed. But then I think it would be our failure as religious studies to ignore their data completely. Definitely. Just because of that.
That's a very good defense. And I mean, an article which really helped with my last dissertation was Geertsen Markussen's Why Religion is Natural and Atheism is Not. Because, you know, that's true. And it's good to have some sort of scientific evidence which shows that people are naturally religious. And this is not saying whether one is, you know, whether it's right to be religious or not. It could be better to not be, or it could be better to be. But, you know, it's really, really helpful to have people out there doing that.
Right, and the types of thought that we tend to do in academia and in science actually require a lot of work and practice and effort, and it's not the type of thing that everybody even has the time or the motivation to persist in.
Yeah, just like Carol Cusack said, we're all referring to Carol Cusack because hers has just been the podcast that's come out. But how the new atheists operate on this mentality that everyone is rational 100% of the time. And rationality is something which is very difficult to keep up, and no one keeps it up 100% of the time. It's not natural.
Right, and that's what the cognitive sciences are actually able to contribute, is they show us the tendency of these heuristic processes, these mental shortcuts that we all make all the time.
Ethan?
I don't even know which parts you're at. I agree with Kevin about the whole idea that the cognitive sciences. I was only speaking to the idea of looking at religion as a, you know, synapses of the brain, sort of via Stan Harris and all that, sort of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you don't need to do that. That sort of misses the point of religion in general. The idea of atheism, of course, to Chris and I, is being a very interesting subject, because where do you draw the line of what is being religious and what is not, and specifically, what does the term religious actually mean? You know, the atheism in its connotation now, the sort of contemporary atheism, as we like to use, because new atheism is specifically, as I define it, is between these four specific authors and five books that they published,
which is now pretty much dead.
Which is pretty much, you know, it's, I wouldn't say it's dead. Yeah, it's just sort of like, that's nice.
They can't say anything
more. It's a voice in a choir of atheism that has existed over hundreds of years. And to sort of pick it out as this is what atheism means now is ridiculous. Mm. It's just not true. It's sort of like saying that all of Christianity is based on one specific ideology between 2006 and 2011. It's just, why would you do that? It's ridiculous.
It's like taking the Council of Nicaea and saying that's Christianity.
That's Christianity. That's all it is. Forever.
That's it.
You know, it's to put it bluntly, it's stupid. And so anyone who likes to argue that new atheism is immoral and is being idiotic. That being said, we sort of have to look at what it means to be religious, or religiosity, or religion in general. That you said something about that atheism. You said something just a second ago that sort of lost me in my
well, that was it leads us on, actually, because it was one of the points that several people made. I thought Marcus Davidson made it very forcefully. I can't remember if Cox mentioned it. Graham Harvey certainly mentioned it. The question of what is religion? What is this thing that we are supposed to be studying, that we are presumably studying? What is it? And I think that's related to the questions we were asking earlier on about defining where we are in the academy.
Hmm.
And Graham Harvey said that this is going to become more and more of an issue over the next few years. Do we agree with that?
But the whole idea of, like, definitions, you know, with the idea, because I do not like definitions. I don't like the concreteness of definitions.
Define
definitions. Well, in my opinion, when people define something, they're basically saying, you know, the whole discussion of lexical real definitions, they're basically saying, you know, such and such is such and such. Like, atheism is, there it is. And they sort of have this idea, or Christianity is, or religion is. And so you sort of have to take religion as, not so much as face value, but you have to understand that it can be applied to so many different aspects of life, and that atheism can be religious. It's sort of my own research that I'm finding that atheism can be religious, but it's difficult to define it as being religion, and you know, you have to sort of
key distinction there. There are religions, there is religion, there is being religious, there is religious type behavior,
or acting religious,
these things, they aren't the same thing,
and it takes effort, it takes work, and it takes effort. You can't just so easily just blase say, oh, a religion,
but it's in the name of our discipline.
We're called to study. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going apparently. Well, the thing is, I do agree with definitions. I don't agree with definitions. Admittedly, the etymology of definitions given by Platvoet is definere, which means to demarcate out. And of course, that has its problems, as in, this is a field that is has a fence around it which no one else can touch. But the words change so much, which is why, you know, the etymology of culture, religion, everything only has so much validity. It does have validity, it does teach us things, but only so much. And this obsession with the word is problematic. nonetheless, I actually believe in definitions. I suppose it's the Edinburgh approach, I think, which I have picked up from Stephen Sutcliffe and James Cox. The obsession with definition is there. I actually think you can define religion.
So my issue is etymology. Is, you know, you need to know the etymology of a term to understand, because you can't look forward without looking back. It's sort of the old axiom that you can't ignore history.
You should.
Or you're plagued by it. Exactly.
You can.
You know, you can even look at the etymology of the term atheism and reach it back to sort of pagan antiquity and know exactly what it means, and sort of argue that, well, early Christians were atheists because they weren't worshipping the Roman emperors as gods, but and they were persecuted for it. Which is essential to understanding what atheism is in the contemporary world.
No, it isn't.
It is essential to understanding it, but it's a part of understanding where the term has gone.
Yes, where the term has come from,
where the term has come from,
as you're saying.
Because you cannot look at something without understanding the history of it in a contemporary aspect.
But the usage then, if we're taking your approach to atheism as a model, the usage of, you know, contemporary pagan authors in the first century differs so much from the modern usage of the term atheism.
But
the modern
train of influence. Though.
There is a train of influence. The fact is, there is a train of influence, and that should be recognised. I'm not denying anything to the studies you've been doing, Ethan. It's just that I would say that ultimately the most important definition of atheism comes from really what atheism means now and how both the public and scholars are applying it now.
Well, it's important now to people who are looking at it now. That's the thing.
But then, surely, otherwise you're simply tracing the word. You're not really tracing the thing. There is an exact thing. Rather, you are tracing this tendency within the human. And for me, the universality of concepts comes from I strangely end up going back to cognitivism here, that actually the universality of concepts up to a point really does come out of the fact that human beings think pretty much the same way. So if there are similar tendencies, the term wouldn't have been used, it wouldn't have exactly the same connotations, but there are some of the same tendencies throughout the human race. Throughout history, effectively, because we are Homo sapiens, and we've always been Homo sapiens.
Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
Well, I was just going to jump in and try to bring us back a bit more the future of religious studies.
Okay.
Which I think, for time reasons, would be good. I was going to ask one thing, but actually, what Liam was saying there has raised another thing. Firstly, is religious studies trying to explain religion? That's one thing. And secondly, what is the future of religious studies outside of the Western Anglophone sort of understanding of religion? We were speaking with a friend last night who had done her initial religious studies degree in China, where everything is very different.
Mm-hmm.
So these are two big issues to consider, I think, in the future of religious studies. Does it have validity outside of a sort of westernized context? And indeed, is it trying to explain things? Go.
It depends on what you mean by explain religion. I mean, yeah. It's not like we're not explaining why the Trinity is correct, or we're not. And so maybe there are certain, once we figure out what exactly it is that we're studying, maybe there are certain things that can be explained by analysis. Other things are not, other ways of looking are not necessarily going for explanation, but description. So I think some things are explained in religious studies by certain types of analysis, but there's other things that are being done other than just explanation, and you can only ever explain certain aspects.
I guess to rephrase the question, maybe, because again, we keep referring to Don Weeb. that's not intentional, he's a good example. But Don Weeb and Luther Martin gave a seminar in Budapest where they were essentially saying, what is the point of religious studies if it isn't trying to explain religion? Like, if it's not trying to... And I guess that there's not another level to that there. Is explaining something explaining it away, or is it understanding it itself?
I don't like the term explanations or explain. Mm. For me, I prefer the term sort of interpret or analyze, because we're not trying to explain something. Because when you explain something, you're giving, you know, again, I get back to, I don't like giving answers. You're sort of giving an answer. So when we explain what Christianity means for a Christian, like, I don't like that idea, because explaining what it means or explaining what Christianity does, I just don't like that. I like more your interpreting. Well, what is specifically case by case? I mean,
or re-describe it. I mean, that's what Jonathan would say, right? Well, probably not Jonathan, but a more classical phenomenologist. We're not trying to explain. We're not saying what the essence of the thing is, but we're re-describing into terms that another audience can understand.
Is there a problem with explaining away? I mean, maybe that term itself is inherently pejorative in the way that it's framed, but if there's something that can be explained away, is there a problem with doing that?
Well, that's again, that's maybe the key question is, we're not saying that religion can be explained away, but there's a certain element of there's a certain maybe fear of if we delve into this too deeply, we might actually find some sort of reason why it all started, and then it will cease to have.
It seems like we're searching for understanding of, like, why does religion exist? You know. For me, I don't really care so much about why religion exists. I mean, it's sort of like we're looking at, you know, why the hell did this happen? You know, it's sort of like we're standing in front of a building that's burned down and wondering.
I'm not looking at the building and saying, why did somebody build that in the first place? I'm saying, what does that building tell us about other buildings?
Yeah, what does that building tell us about the people who built it, essentially?
So, my work's showing up a lot of the similarities in the way of thinking between the strongly religious and the conspiracy worldview.
Yeah.
And so I'm not seeking to explain. I'm not going to go, oh, if I can describe the reason that people look for hidden forces in the universe in religious terms as a theodicy or, you know, whatever, it doesn't make conspiracy theories disappear.
No.
And never is going to, nor is anybody going to go, oh, yeah, that's exactly, he's right, that's what I believe. I'm not a conspiracist anymore. But rather, it elucidates currents of thought and epistemology and what it is to think like a human.
Yeah. Well, and so that's part of what I'm saying is it the role of the religious studies scholar to somehow, like, maintain the mystery of religion or something?
Crickets or caretakers. which is our next question, so let's not do this, because that'll be the next time we do it.
That sort of idea that we destroy the mystery, you know, by trying to analyze it too much, we're destroying the mystery process.
I mean, my point was more that religious studies, well, should it care effectively, like, being truly neutral, I guess trying to be truly neutral, is whether we explain away the mystery, and that's not our concern.
Right.
Our concern is to look at the phenomena. and deal with it, mm-hmm. and explore it, and whatever people do with that, it's not really our problem. But sticking with the university thing, I know that Liam had something to talk about concerning the whole financial situation and offering his own personal take on the whole thing.
Thanks very much. Yes, I mean, the thing is, to pick up on Ethan's point, there's a lot of folk that they just think they can have a vocational degree and they don't always get, they always get a fairly substandard vocational degree and don't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. The fact is, to do my first postgraduate degree, I hope to do another one, is I had to actually do a full-time job for the first year. And at the end of the day, I think it's just perseverance. Mm. You know, I wasn't offered any money at all, any funding, but I think it can be done. And I think, you know, once you just realise that perseverance, you know, that there are groups like the British Association for the Study of Religion out there which try to help young scholars, you know, that if you do take an interest in things like religious studies or other humanities subjects, which are all underfunded and all have a role to play in society, then you need to realise that there are groups out there that will help you, like the British Association for the Study of Religion, and that you can do it, basically. You should try and do it. I'm hoping to actually get some kind of funding for this PhD. We'll have to see. But the fact is, I actually did the first year of my master's self-funded, and I don't regret it. So
that's something that we have very different from you guys here, is that when it comes to funding, we can apply for financial aid, and depending on how much you've taken, you can either get grants or loans. And at my point in time, I'm getting mostly loans, but they really just don't care what you're studying. They don't even ask. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of, oh, you need to go to university? Okay. Mm-hmm.
That has a lot to do with football and the US, doesn't it? If you're good at football,
I think that's completely separate entirely, but the idea that college football is very essential. But for us who want to go into higher education, postgraduate degrees, or as we call graduate programs, masters or PhDs, they just don't care. Mm-hmm. You fill out the form. It is very sterile. And I'm going through the process right now. You fill out the form. You tell them what you've done in your taxes, what you paid, essentially, how much you've worked if you're dependent or independent, depending on your age. And then they give you money. For me, it's all loans right now, because I've gone through all of my grants, which is just essentially free money. It's all loans right now, but they just don't care. So it's very interesting when I talk to Liam about funding, as we call it, but actually getting money from a government entity to go to university, they seem to care what you're going to study.
Yes.
Well, in the US, they just don't give a shit what you're going to study, because, you know, oh, you're going to go to university, that's great. We've got a whole federal government who's going to finance that. Just make sure you pay it back.
I mean, the thing is, they just dismiss the humanities, but then one or two humanities scholars will just get lots of funding. And it sometimes that's, you know, okay.
Which just seems it has to
do with of their own, you might say.
It has to do with government pledges. It's because the Tory party promised they wouldn't cut medicine and science, right? Yeah. These are the things that the hard sciences, right? Research sciences, things which will lead to technologies which we can sell, right?
Cancer,
so it's engineering and scanning of various types.
iPhones.
Yeah, and solar cells. But the problem was they promised that, and then the market collapsed. So they're in this situation where they go, right, we need to cut education by 20% in like 2 years, but we also promised we wouldn't cut any of this stuff. So what they did was they ring-fenced that and said, well, how does that translate? And basically what that meant was humanities is gone.
Yeah.
There is no Humanities Research Council anymore. And it's going to have an enormous impact in the next 2 years.
Which is ridiculous, because, you know, for me, I don't know about Kevin, but I look at sort of the Republican primaries that are going on now, and some of the candidates who are being offered up as the Republican Party nominee, I look at, if this individual became president, I would have to worry, because education would just basically be slashed. But as it stands now, I don't think we really have to worry about getting funding from the U.S., because it's just the federal government just says, oh, you're going to university, that's fine, we'll give you a loan,
Yeah. Promise to pay it back. We don't care what you do. It could be anything. It could be as ridiculous as religious studies.
that's more or less the same here. I mean, they lent me £16,000.
So it almost seems like they actually are being more responsible and saying, oh, religious studies, what are you going to do with that? Well, that's right. You can work at Starbucks. Why would we give you a loan?
The fact is that there is no funding, there's no student awards agency to even give you a loan for a postgraduate degree. So, you know, basically, it attempts to cut out the working class from postgraduates.
Yes, it's the policy is not that the Scottish Government is supporting higher education per se. The Scottish Government is supporting the institutionalisation of a degree in every job and trade in the industry, so that you cannot be a nurse, which used to be you know, a semi-trained or a trained working class, is now you have to go to get a degree which costs £16,000. You can't be a chef without going to college and doing at least an HND. You can't be any of these things which used to be semi-skilled manual labour, even 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But the idea that you go to university and you learn, you are trained as an intellectual, it's gone.
But coming from a chef who is having a PhD.
I didn't do any training as a chef.
This whole difference between American culture and UK culture, you know, because you guys always talk about the sort of this caste system in the UK, but you don't really understand it. When you put it in these terms, it makes sense to me. You know, I sort of look at it, you talk about a caste system, and I think, I don't know really what you're talking about until you put it in these sort of terms. And it's sort of like in the US, they just don't care. But here, they actually do take an interest. Mm-hmm. I was saying earlier, it's sort of like a grandparent paying for your education as long as you get a business degree. You know, it's sort of like in the US, they just don't care. We'll throw money at you as long as you pay it back, because you're crazy like that, because that's what we do. But here it's sort of like, yeah, that's great. You want to go to a postgraduate degree, you want to get a PhD, that's fine. Get it in something that's actually going to apply to you working later. Then we'll give you money. Otherwise,
that's been the huge shift.
Thank you.
That's been the huge shift in education in the last 10 years.
Because you used to just be able to go and do whatever. Yeah. If you wanted to go. Yeah. Especially, no one wanted to do post-grad work. Yeah. If you had a slight inclination, the government would just pay for it.
Now it's almost getting to the point where, well, everybody's got a degree, so if you want to be something that's slightly higher than your basic bit in your trade, then you go and do a master's.
The idea that we sort of look at, when you guys talk about, oh, God, I have to pay, like, certain amount of money to pay for education, I think, like, if I could even tell you the amount of money I'm paying to come to school here, which is cheaper than it is in the U.S., which is not why I'm here, but, you know, it was a plus. But, you know, the idea of the amount of money it costs to go to school to get a postgraduate degree, a doctorate in the U.S., is so outrageous that I have to use the word to describe it.
And we might just put it as explicit on iTunes.
Yeah, because, you know, to go to a private university.
Anybody who's listened this long is not going to care. Yeah.
You won't care because you don't understand.
We're over an hour in now.
Yeah. But to get a PhD in the US, you're looking at $38,000 to $40,000 a year to get a PhD. If you go to a private university, that's maybe 3 to 4 years. If you go to a public school, yes, it's cheaper, but you're still paying the same amount of money. To come here, you know, which is why the Americans are taking over
You get funding to do it, though.
We do get funding, but we don't get funding that it's like, hey, let's go to school. We'll give you a loan as long as you promise to pay it back.
I'm a foolish person. I would do. Had I been given a loan, I would have taken one.
We're all foolish.
Yeah, we're all foolish. Let's be honest. We're getting postgraduates.
Yeah, this is true.